We'll have the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Wednesday, and a lovely day we have. Peek at spring, perhaps. We're going to go a little bit out of order, because I know we have some people here. Representative Van Orman, I believe, is here, is on House Bill 3649. So let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3649. Mr. Stembridge.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3649A allows pre-1995 non-utility-owned certified low-impact hydroelectric power facilities to qualify for compliance with the renewable portfolio standards. It authorizes up to 40 average megawatts of electricity per year.
Okay. Am I right, Representative Van Orman? You're here for this bill?
Yes,
okay.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Suzanne Van Orman.
Sorry, take your time. Go ahead and sit down before you talk. It's all right. You're fine. We're in no hurry here.
That's true. I have a tendency
your
to rush.
Reputation, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair Metzger. I am Representative Suzanne Van Orman. I represent House District 52, which is half of Senator Metzger's district, and that includes Hood River County, 15 precincts in Clackamas, and two precincts in Multnomah County. So I have a wide area. House Bill 3649 makes minor modifications in the Renewable Portfolio Standard Bill passed in 2007 to allow small, green, non-utility-owned hydroelectric projects built before 1995 to qualify for renewable energy credits. The RPS already includes certified low-impact hydro projects built before 1995 if those projects are owned by a utility. This bill applies the same standard to non-utility-owned projects. To qualify, these projects must be certified by the Low Impact Hydroelectric Institute as showing they have avoided or reduced their environmental impacts. Currently, four projects are certified and four more have applications pending. Accordingly, ownership should not be the standard for inclusion in the RPS. Instead, it should be passed on the environmental criteria. House Bill 3649 would allow up to an annual average of 40 megawatts of non-utility-owned hydro to be added to the RPS. The benefits of this bill would include environmental. Low-impact certification requires that a project maintain the highest level of environmental compatibility, meaning they protect water and fish quality. Economic. Providing RPS eligibility to older projects gives the owners of those projects the economic incentive and economic means to extend the life of those renewable projects in an environmentally sound manner. And its benefit to ratepayers. Older renewable projects are far less expensive to ratepayers than building new projects. Both create the same renewable benefits. They provide Oregon with the least expensive sources of renewable energy. And I must add that I am one of the satisfied customers of the Farmers Irrigation District, which does meet the Lehigh standards. And this is a simple bill that will have little impact on the RPS, but be a huge boost for these small hydro projects in our rural communities especially.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for Representative Van Orman? Thank you.
Thank you.
Barber, Mr. Mason, you want to come up and join us as well?
Thank you, Chair Metzger. Doug Barber here today representing a coalition of irrigation districts and other providers of low-impact hydropower in Oregon. You're handing out a PowerPoint presentation that I'm not going to go through in detail.
Thank you.
I just want to call your attention to a couple of pages in there. I think Representative Van Orman did a great job of outlining how simple this bill is, this change from utility-owned to include non-utility-owned. On the third page, it talks a little bit more about the low-impact hydro certification process. There are more than 3,000 hydro projects in the United States. 46 of them have been certified, four here in Oregon, four more are applying. A couple of others are in the process of making that application. You can see there's a map in the packet see where these projects are located. Most of them are owned by small irrigation districts in central Oregon, primarily. On about the eighth page, you will see these are slides from the Farmers Irrigation District, which just received their low-impact hydro certification. It shows you their hydro facility, and on the lower right-hand corner, the photo there is the new innovative fish screen that they have installed. They developed it. They're now marketing it, actually, to other irrigation districts. And it's just an indication of the kinds of steps that these projects will take to meet the low-impact hydro certification to prove that they protect fish and protect water quality. And on the final page, talks about the key reasons to pass the bill. Representative Van Orman summarized those. I won't go into any more detail. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barber. Mr. Mason.
Chair Metzger and members of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, a pleasure to be here today. My name is Michael Mason. I represent the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, and here today specifically for the Warm Springs Power and Water Enterprise, which manages the Pelton re-regulating dam on the Deschutes River. That's long been low-impact hydro certified since the 1980s, and so it's the first Lehigh certified project in the state. And we're just glad to be here to work together with the irrigation districts on improving projects for fish. Do you think this is the wave of the future? You know, the retrofitting of existing dams. You may have seen the Capitol Press last week comment on how few dams actually have hydropower turbines associated with them in the West. So we think this is another help to that process and making sure that fish are protected as we have increased renewable power generation. It just doesn't make sense for this to have been left out of the renewable portfolio standard. It was an oversight, I think, in 2007. So I did want to call your attention as well to the Hood River News from last Saturday, which has a story about House Bill 3649 on the front page. And a quote from Mike Kleinsmith of the Farmers Irrigation District, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, so you have to listen to the more boring presentations of the lobbyists. But again, thank you, and glad to answer any questions you might have.
Well, thank you,
3649.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. And colleagues, remember, we discussed this last year within biomass. There was a number of issues regarding the RPS, and I'm, you know, personally pleased that we've kind of come to move a number of these things forward and recognize that we want to provide incentives, not disincentives, just because of the age or time. Questions for any of our panelists?
Okay.
What a thorough job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3649A? Now we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3649A. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3649A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry the bill? We don't get too many bills, you know, so all right. Senator Schrader will carry. Thank you. You don't have many bills this session, so. Okay. Then let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3690.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3690A deletes the requirement that solar voltaic energy systems have the primary purpose of meeting electric companies' customer load service obligation in order to be qualifying systems for the purpose of the solar voltaic energy system pilot project. It changes some definitions, and it does a number of other things to the to that program.
Okay. Seth Prickett.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Seth Prickett. I'm here representing the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. First of all, I'd like to thank you for passing 3039 last session. I think it's a step in the right direction, and it's going to help us get more renewable energy out there in the state, as well as get our Oregonians back to work. From my understanding, all of the stakeholders are in agreement on this, and we urge your support.
Would you just, for the public record, we have this, but for those who might be listening, just briefly summarize what it does in terms of changing what we did in 3039?
There's the Department of Justice has determined that the State of Oregon's Public Utility Commission doesn't have the authority to set specific incentive rates for solar under this program. So this is, we have a couple of workarounds to give the PUC that authority.
Is there any questions for Mr. Prickett? Okay, anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3690? If not, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3690A.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3690A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr, you're our solar guy. You want to carry that?
I'll carry it.
Okay. Let's see our next one. All right, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3691. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3691A allows above-market costs associated with compliance with Renewable Portfolio Standard, as the RPS, to be recoverable in electric companies' rates. It allows above-market costs associated with compliance with solar voltaic energy capacity standard to be recoverable in electric companies' rates. I would point out that many of the costs are allowable presently, but not the term. The term above market cost is missing from the statute.
Thank you. Mr. Bissonnette. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers. And this is bill is a technical fix to language that we originally had in Senate Bill 838 from 2007 and then from House Bill 3039 that we were just discussing that was passed last year. And basically what we did unintentionally was to taint some projects that receive public purpose funds, and by law, public purpose funds go to support above market costs. And what we unintentionally did originally in the RPS and then took that same DNA over to 3039 was to say that these costs were not above market costs just because they're a little bit more expensive. And so that was what we intended to do. What we didn't intend to do was to taint any ratepayer dollars that went through the public purpose charge and prevent them from qualifying either through the RPS or from for House Bill 3039. And so what this does is basically makes it the technical fix and says that above market costs are not necessarily a bad thing as long as they're prudently incurred and there's there are processes at the PUC to determine that. So, again, very technical fix. All the stakeholders are in agreement that this fixes the problem from customer groups, utilities, PUC, et cetera. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions for Mr. Bissonnette? Thank you. Anyone else wish to testify in 3691? We have other stakeholders here. Anybody? Would you like to testify?
No.
Oh, okay. That was the audience voice saying that, for those of you at home saying good bill. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3691A.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3691 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd like to vote no.
Okay. Please note Senator George has an objection. It passes. And Senator Berger, would you carry the bill?
Sure.
No. Okay. What we're going to do now is I'm going to hold off on our last bill for a second. I'll get to it. But let's open the informational hearing on the low carbon fuel standard rulemaking. And well, let's get them in here. We're going to start by hearing Andy. give us an overview, and then others who hopefully would like to comment on how the process is going. This is, as you remember, colleagues, 2186 requires the establishment of a low-carbon fuel standard. There was a lot of discussion about how this would work and making sure that stakeholders were at the table and working collaboratively, and we want to see if that's happening.
Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind my butting in here.
Please.
We did provide for each of the members of the committee a list of the committee membership, a schematic from the DEQ website on how the rulemaking is going to be taking place, the process, and also a copy of the enrolled House Bill 2186, which was the origin of the process.
Thank you, Mr. Stavridge. Welcome.
Great, thanks for that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ, here to give you an update on House Bill 2186 and specifically the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. As you know, the goal of that program is to reduce the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions from transportation fuels by 10% from 2010 to 2020. And just to differentiate it from the renewable fuel standard, the renewable fuel standard requires a certain amount of biofuels to be blended into transportation fuels. But the low carbon fuel standard doesn't have any mandated percentages of biofuels or any specific method required for compliance. It's a performance standard, basically requiring a 10% reduction in life cycle greenhouse gas emissions. It can be met by blending biofuels. It can also be met by using electricity, natural gas, hydrogen, or any other low carbon fuel. The other states in the area have either adopted or are considering adopting a low-carbon fuel standard. California was the first in the nation to adopt it. Their rule is going into effect this year and in sort of a reporting initial kickoff phase. Washington is considering a similar program under an executive order from their governor, and they'll be making a report back to their governor about the same time as our committee will be wrapping up its report. And then the Northeast states are all have entered into a compact to develop a low-carbon fuel standard together. The bill that was adopted last session has a number of important protections in it. I'll just run through them really quickly. First, it requires us to ensure that there's adequate fuel supplies and to defer the requirements if they would interfere with that. It requires that the price of fuel has to remain competitive with the neighboring states and requires us to defer requirements if it won't. It ensures fuel quality and requires us to evaluate safety, feasibility, cost effectiveness, and ensure that the overall program creates a net benefit for greenhouse gases and other pollutants. It also requires us to allow for flexible compliance options and specifically exempts farm and log vehicles. Then, in addition, it provides for ongoing legislative oversight of the program. It requires that we, first, that the rules cannot go into effect until July 2011, after the 2011 legislative session, and also that the whole program will sunset on December 31st, 2015. So if it's going to be implemented through the 2020 timeframe, it would have to be reauthorized by 2015. And then it also requires regular reports to interim committees and to the legislature. As you heard, we've moved into our advisory committee phase. We have a 29-member advisory committee. It's chaired by Mark Reeve, who is a former Environmental Quality Commission chair and who also has chaired a number of other advisory committees for us. It includes the fuel suppliers, so there's the petroleum suppliers and the fuel distributors are on the committee, as well as the low-carbon fuel suppliers, which would include electricity, natural gas, biofuels, ethanol, and hydrogen. And then it has fuel users, including truckers, the Automobile Association, the Farm Bureau, barges, rails, and general contractors. And then there's, in addition, a number of other members, including public interest, environmental organizations, academic, local government, and general members of the public. So it's a very large committee, but we thought that was important because the program could affect a number of people, and we want to make sure that we've got broad input from everyone. The committee's had 3 meetings so far, and there's 7 additional meetings that are planned for this year. Our topics are things like which fuels are covered, on how will the exemptions work, how do we conduct our life cycle analysis, how do we set the baseline life cycle greenhouse gas emissions for the fuel that we have today, what will be the compliance schedule. And the compliance schedule does include a very gradual phase-in of the requirements. Most in the early years, very little reduction. In the later years, more of the reduction. And that allows time for advanced biofuels and things like that to be developed. It includes, topics also include the deferrals, the consumer cost safety net, compliance scenarios, and then importantly an economic analysis. We're fortunate to get a grant from EPA to hire an economic contractor. We're developing the RFP for that right now, and so we'll have a thorough analysis of the economic effects of the program that will be presented to the committee. Reporting requirements and how the regulated parties would demonstrate compliance. So our schedule is that we have our additional committee meetings through May of this year, and then in June the committee will meet with the contractor who's going to be doing the economic analysis to discuss the inputs to the economic modeling. Then during July and August the economic contractor will do their work, and in September report back to the committee. In October we have a report to the interim committees. And then in November and December, the committee will wrap up its work. And at that point, we'll have a final report from our committee along with a draft rule. So by the time we enter the 2011 legislative session, we'll actually have a draft of the regulation that we would consider adopting. But we won't adopt it yet until after the 2011 legislative session. After that, we'll have implementation, and then the bill requires ongoing reporting to the next several legislative assemblies. So that's my brief update on Low Carbon Fuel Center. Just to mention really quickly, there are a couple of other activities going on following up with legislation from last session. Also in House Bill 2186, we were directed to evaluate a legislative concept for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from trucks, looking at truck efficiency and idling. That work group will be getting started soon, and that will have a report to the interim committees in October. Then we have in Senate Bill 38, a revision to our greenhouse gas reporting program. We have another advisory committee that's working with us on that. EPA on the national level has announced that they're going to be adopting standards for light-duty vehicles and trucks in March that will be similar to the regulations that California adopted, limiting the greenhouse gas emissions from those vehicles. And since we have opted into the California program, we will need to revise our program to conform to the new federal requirements. And then another major issue coming up for us is that once EPA starts regulating cars, greenhouse gas emissions from cars on a federal level, that automatically requires that we begin permitting stationary sources, industrial facilities, with regard to their greenhouse gas emissions. So all of the EPA is now currently evaluating how is that going to work, and they're developing regulations to define how that program will work, and we'll. We're told that they'll be finishing that in March, so we'll find out what those requirements will be. And that will be a major new activity, obviously, for our agency that we'll be discussing with the legislature in 2011. So that's my quick report on what's going on with us with greenhouse gas emissions. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg. On your advisory committee, have you been getting good participation from the members who are listed here?
Yeah, Chair Metzger, we've had just about everyone coming to every meeting. We've had a few people that had to send alternates. We've set it up at the committee's request so that we do have call-in options and web ability to participate by web. And in particular for the petroleum industry, because they're the most affected regulated party, and many of their members who have expertise in the Low Carbon Fuel Standard are in Sacramento. They've worked very closely with California in the development of their rules. We've provided an opportunity for them to participate through the web and through a conference line and through their representative that's on the committee. So we're trying to bend over backwards to make sure everyone can be heard, and they are coming to the meetings.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Ginsburg? Senator Berger.
Let me just start out by saying that I really agree that we need to reduce the carbon footprint and the greenhouse gases. And so starting from that point of view and having you accept that from me, I have some concerns, and maybe you can explain them in Section 10. Where this task force, which is the MPO Greenhouse Task Force, it says in Section D, small a, study and evaluate the development of alternative land use and transportation scenarios that accommodate planned population and employment growth. So what I see, and it's a pattern, is that we have something that's good, and we want to try to make it better, and we want to explain it, study it. And you're going to look at trucks, and you're going to be looking at making people get better products, and you put some pressure on manufacturers nationwide by getting them to do this. And now we're into employment growth. Now, explain to me that this isn't going to go off on a good tangent and have the unintended consequences of overreaching and getting involved in areas that this was not intended to be involved in.
Chair Metzger, Senator Verger, first let me say that that provision of the bill is being implemented by ODOT and DLCD, so it's not a DEQ program. I can give you a brief explanation of it,
okay.
But you probably should have ODOT fully explain it. But that provision has to do with the Metropolitan Planning Organization's in their planning for future growth of their road system and their transportation system to account for and look at how much greenhouse gas emissions come from their system. So it's not a requirement to actually reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, but it is a planning requirement to look at different scenarios for designing the land use and transportation system to reduce the vehicle miles traveled. DEQ's role in that is simply to provide some inputs to that work, where we would explain how much greenhouse gas emissions will come out of cars per mile and how much greenhouse gas emissions would come from the fuel, so that they can estimate how much reduction in vehicle miles travel would be needed to meet the state's greenhouse gas goals. So that was a starting point for planning. There's been additional legislation during this session to flesh out how that will work. And again, I'm not the expert on that program, so I'd recommend having someone from ODOT explain it.
Okay. Senator Starr and I both belong to the Road User Fee Task Force, which has done a lot of the vehicles mile travel study. Can you expand on population growth? Can you explain that?
Yes, Senator Metzger, Senator Verger, I believe the concept is that as the metropolitan planning organizations are designing the road system to handle growth in population and to handle growth in employment, they will be building a system that has greenhouse gas emissions. The result of expanding the transportation system would be increased vehicle miles traveled, unless they take measures to accommodate that growth in other ways through alternate transportation means, through improved land use design, to try and accommodate the growth in population and employment while not increasing vehicle miles traveled. And I think that's what the reference is about.
Is this a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Is this also in other bills other than, is it found anywhere else, or is it Section 10 as the one I'm referring to?
Chair Metzger, Senator Verger, there's two other related bills, House Bill 2001 from 2009,
mm-hmm.
And also, I'm not sure I remember the number correctly, it might be Senate Bill 1059. Is that the right number? From this session, that was a follow-up to this legislation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Starr.
Thank you. Yeah, to answer your question, Senator Verger, there is part of the Section 10 of this bill requires this task force to recommend legislation to the Interim Legislative Assembly, and that's Senate Bill 1059.
Okay. So I didn't vote for this bill, 2186. I think it's terrible public policy. I think it's going to ruin Oregon. It's certainly going to make it more difficult for businesses to do business in this state and make us less attractive for companies to do business here. And I would suggest that Senate Bill 1059 is a follow-on, which equally is damaging to Oregon's economic growth and prosperity as this bill is. The question I have for you is based on, there's only a couple of states that are moving aggressively forward with this low-carbon fuel standard, California being the primary one. My understanding is that California is being sued currently. They're related to their low-carbon fuel standard. I think a couple of suits, one from the American Trucking Associations, the other one from, I think, one of the petroleum associations. Based on what you know of those of that process in California and where we're headed in Oregon, can we expect that we're going to have to fund through the Department of Justice lawsuits and this is even going to cost the state budget even more money because we're going to get sued based on where you're headed with this?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, you're absolutely right that California has, I believe at this point, two lawsuits related to the low-carbon fuel standard. I don't know all the details of the legal theories under which those lawsuits were brought, but we have been informed by the Department of Justice that some of those theories could affect our authority as well. And so we're tracking very closely those lawsuits, although they're in the very early stages and not much has happened yet. Probably by the time we get to adopting our regulations, we'll know a lot more about it. So we'll know whether or not, for example, our authority is preempted under federal law, or if there are specific parts of the low-carbon fuel standard that would be preempted or would have to be handled in a different way to be legal. And so, you know, we'll benefit from seeing how the lawsuit with California evolves, but I think we have to expect that in this area, because it's a new area, there will be lawsuits. It's likely that all the EPA's rules will receive legal challenges, will all state rules. So what we can do is you know, first of all, be as smart as possible in the way we design the programs to avoid pitfalls and learn from what the experience of other states are and just continue to evaluate it as we go. So I don't really know the merits of the cases, whether they, you know, whether they have a likelihood of succeeding or not.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So, in DEQ's budget, are you for the next biennium? Are you including significant dollars to defend the state in these potential lawsuits based on what's happening in California? And what's that going to cost the state budget when we're faced with reducing class sizes, cutting school days? We're going to go ahead and go full steam ahead on this and end up having to use state dollars that we ought to be spending elsewhere to defend this cockamamie scheme?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, we haven't yet put together our budget request for 2011, so I can't exactly answer your question. But I can say that there's a great deal of efficiency in working with our partner states, typically on an issue like this where we would be doing a regulation that's very similar to California's regulation and very similar to regulations being pursued in the Northeast. It's not likely that a smaller state like Oregon would be in the lead on a lawsuit, in particular because California's ahead of us. They'll, you know, at this point the lawsuit is just with regard to California. So I wouldn't anticipate that it would be a really significant legal expense for us to participate as an amicus in a lawsuit that covers similar issues to what we're involved in. And, you know, recognizing that the remedy in this case of a portion of our rule were determined to be illegal, that we can change the rule or repeal the rule. So there wouldn't be significant follow-up costs even. But I think our main strategy at this point would be to partner with other states and participate by adding our legal analysis and make sure that the issues covered in their lawsuit are also covering the issues that are relevant for our proposed regulation.
Let me go to Senator George and we'll come back then.
Sure. Thank you very much. I want to ask you a little bit about the geographic diversity of our state. Specifically is that primarily a lot of our business interests are right along the I-5 corridor from Eugene to Portland. when I read the section that the senator from South Oregon Coast was mentioning about land use transportation, what we've heard so far about this is that the urban planning models that folks are looking to use are centered around planning models that talk about bringing in densities from rural areas and condensing them into tighter areas, specifically new urbanism, those type of things, that would talk about sort of depopulating certain parts of our state to bring those populations closer to reduce the carbon footprint. And so the first thing that makes me think of is that when you start talking about these issues, you have a tire company in Central Oregon who is committed to their community, or you have a sawmill on the South Oregon coast who's committed to the community. How would these regulations affect those companies that are investing in the more remote or distant parts of our state? It seems like to me, are we differentiating how these regulations may impact low population areas that may be long distance away that you can only get there by truck? Or could these regulations, the way they're being drafted, kind of one size fit all, really damage some of our more remote rural communities? So if you could address that generally, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay. Chair Metzger, Senator George, were you referring specifically to Section 10 or the bill more generally?
Bill more generally, actually. I just thought what Senator Verger brought up was really key in this, because the land use portion of it is clearly trying to draw people away from the rural areas and centralize them in the Willamette Valley. But then the rest of it, all these air quality things, tax proposals, fees, will really drive any business looking to invest outside the Willamette Valley. It will create a huge disincentive to invest anywhere else in the state.
So with regard to the low-carbon fuel standard, which is the most significant part of this legislation and the part that DEQ is implementing, the requirement is that the fuel itself, when you look at it on its whole life cycle, considering from the point where the production of the fuel and the refining of the fuel and the transportation and ultimately the use of the fuel, when you consider the emissions all up and down the life cycle of the fuel, that we reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. So from the standpoint of the user, a trucker that's going across the state or users in a rural community, they're just going to have fuel. It'll be fuel to them that will meet the specs that they require of fuel. Something like 90% of the fuel that's used in Oregon is manufactured in Washington refineries, comes to us through pipeline and through barges, and is distributed throughout the state. Some fuel comes in from California, and some a little bit overland in eastern Oregon. But all that fuel coming into the state will be compliant with the rules, and so it's not going to have a differential effect on different parts of the state with regard to the low-carbon fuel standard.
Follow-up program. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm talking about is there any discussion in the work group or in a study, is there any discussion about how these regulations could be applied differently to different areas of the state in relationship to the economic harm that these regulations could cause in certain parts of the state? My district is right along I-5. In fact, it just pretty much goes down I-5. For the most part, my district will probably be least affected by all of these regulations. But then I think about Senator Verger or perhaps Senator Farioli's district. They could be dramatically hit by the overall picture of this bill. And is there any discussion about how we make this applicable to the whole state without hurting pockets of our state that are more remote populated? Is that discussion come up at all?
Senator George, with regard to the low carbon fuel standard, the answer is no, because that standard applies to the fuel as a whole, and it needs to be uniform. And in fact, we're looking at having similar requirements in California, Washington, and Oregon. So, that particular program really can't be differentiated for different parts of the state. The Section 10, with regard to the metropolitan planning organizations, really is focused on those parts of the state. I think there are six areas that have metropolitan planning organizations, and those requirements only apply within those areas. So that portion, and again, I'm not the expert on that part of the bill, but that portion is targeted to different parts of the state. The other piece is that DEQ is responsible for with the truck efficiency and idling. That is at this point, it's an evaluation with a report back to the legislature, so there's no program at this stage. We're hoping to have recommendations in at the October interim committees. And so, for example, when we look at an idling restriction, I think your point could come into play here, where in more urbanized areas there may be more alternatives for idling. For example, in some places you can plug in rather than idle to keep a cab warm, and you'd want to have a program that recognizes that in rural areas you won't have those kind of alternatives. So you definitely would want to design a program that had flexibility for how it might apply in more rural areas when you're thinking about idling, as an example. So that committee has not yet begun, but that is an issue that's already identified that I know will be addressed when they do begin.
Senator Virgil.
Yes, thank you. I thank you for differentiating what you're here for, and I appreciate that. I ask your questions that other people are taking that part of the program. I am concerned about that part of the policy, however. But let me just say this. You and I are partners. You work for an agency, and I come as an elected person. And so when we're working on legislation, you're brought in to many groups to give your advice, to give counsel, and so forth. And I would just beg of you as my partner to look at, always consider the economic impacts when you're advising elected people to go forward with legislation, because those impacts really affect people's lives. And I'm sure you're doing the greatest job with the list of to-dos that you have. But what I'd like for you to do is think creatively sometimes, and don't just take that list as a line in the sand that can't be flexible and move when we need it very badly in Oregon. So thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Other questions? I have a few observations. As you move forward on this, and these aren't certainly anything new, but I think they're really important, regarding the low carbon fuel standard. You mentioned a number of ways in which this can be met, including the increased use of alternative fuel vehicles like electric, whatever. And I think it is important to, as you look at the whole global picture of what really is the carbon footprint, so if you're talking about electric vehicles, that you have to include the source of that electricity and what is the cost of producing that, because it isn't just necessarily lower carbon because it's electric, if it all comes from, for example, coal, or the transportation of other fuels, and what is the cost of that. I know a lot's been made, a lot of discussion, and increasingly less enthusiasm certainly for corn-based ethanol, as to whether the fact that we don't see the forests in Brazil that are being raped to plant this stuff, thinking that we're good environmentally because we're using something that has a lower BTU rating and people use more fuel. Those aren't new issues, but they obviously have to be included if we're going to get an honest picture of what we're trying to create. I think that's really, really important for the committee. I do see you have one person, Mr. Patterson from Mitsubishi R&D. It represents those who manufacture vehicles. And I will put not only a legitimate plug-in for my interest in classic cars, but for those who drive regular cars that are 1990. It is imperative that when you look at the cost, you also have to look and ensure that you don't disenfranchise anybody who's driving a 1980s any kind of car, early 1990s car. If you're looking at increasing ethanol standards, and some. Current manufacturer warranties don't cover if we increase where we are to now, or at least it puts it very much in jeopardy. Those people who have, like I have a 1960 Impala downstairs, barely runs now, and it would not do that. And it's not just like this should be an isolated thing. Certainly, even just the collector car, and I don't mean necessarily old cars, I mean 80s, early 90s cars, are part of a different part. They're not really part of the major transportation system. They're probably, 2% of the entire things on the road, but it's a multi-billion dollar industry and hobby and everything else. And there's that has to be considered going forward. You can't to look at, they're not going to have a major carbon footprint, but it's important not to eliminate that from the American landscape or all the different things that are associated and the economic impacts of that entire industry, hobby, participation, the rallies, all the things that take place.
And it isn't not, it's not just enough, as you, I think you're aware, is to just say, well, we can make exemptions. Exemptions won't do anything if the way it's written doesn't produce a market for someone to be able to have a tank, you know, of alternative fuel for these types of specialty things. And of course, in other areas of industry, there are those niche things, but this is really important, and especially for people who are less affluent and who will be driving cars for many, many years to come, is to not basically see that all of those are, you know, totally unavailable, or that more cost is coming out of their pockets, out of the economy, in order to fix things. I that's a real global picture. You know, the fact is, and I think you're probably aware of this, the emissions from today's manufactured cars is over 80% less than it was in the 1960s. I mean, in terms of emissions already, for the average car, is emitting less than, you know, more than 80% has been reduced just in what's been happening in terms of the development of the internal combustion engine. So, and the fact that most people over a period of time will change, you know, their cars, that will continue to help contribute to whatever we do moving forward and those who manufacture. But let's don't leave everybody behind and understand that that's an important part of the economy. And then that's my statement. But the one question I want to, and we had a discussion about this before session, is that we discussed in greenhouse well, areas with smog, and then going to a different area, you know, especially the southern Oregon and the metro area, with our DEQ testing stations. And I asked for you for data, and we had a nice visit about that, that, you know, over 97%, 98% of all cars now pass, you know, going through immediately. And that's because technology has changed, and they're made to pass. And yet we continue to pay and have employees in these buildings to test things now that are essentially rubber stamped because they're clean. It isn't like the 1970s when we had so many people who failed because they were all carbureted and you had all the different issues. Now that we're moving, especially to low carbon fuel, and even increasing those emission reductions, I just wonder about. Is this a dinosaur? I mean, why are we not looking at maybe eliminating these DEQ testing stations when they don't seem to be necessary anymore? It's a long question, and I'm sorry, but you know, it's just like that was fine in the 70s, just like, you know, certain cars were fine in the 70s, but now it's just kind of like a pro forma that people have to shell out the money to go do it and stand in line and idle to get approved.
Well, Chair Metzger, let me first say that your earlier point illustrates the exact topics that our advisory committee is working on. Those issues are front and center to our discussion to ensure that the greenhouse gas emissions are considered not just from the use of the electric car, but also from the, you know, the production of the electricity. That we look at the difference between corn ethanol and cellulosic ethanol and their life cycle emissions. So those are exactly the issues, as well as the cost. So you can be assured that those issues are being addressed by the advisory committee. With regard to the vehicle inspection program, a couple of important points to consider. One is that the purpose of vehicle inspection is to ensure that vehicles are properly maintained, that the emission control systems on vehicles are properly maintained, so those vehicles achieve the emission standards that EPA sets when the cars are new, that they're capable of setting, taking into account as they age that they can't meet the standard that they first met, but what they should be able to meet. And as cars have been turned over, as you pointed out, the emissions are much lower from newer cars, but those cars have very high technology emission control systems designed to keep those emissions low, and if those systems fail, the emissions can be much higher. So maintaining, you know, ensuring that we're maintaining the emission control systems continues to be important. Now, it is true that the failure rate for newer vehicles is fairly low. The failure rate for older vehicles is much greater. But that is in the case where we have an ongoing testing program. People know that every 2 years before they can register their vehicle, they're going to have their vehicle tested. And what happens is people maintain those vehicles so that they don't fail the test. And we actually have evidence from doing testing in other areas of Oregon outside of our testing boundaries that shows much higher failure rates for vehicles, even brand new vehicles, than vehicles that are inside the testing boundary. So there's a preventative effect, and that's really what we're going for. We don't want the cars to have high emissions up until the day we test them and then fail them and have them go repair the car so that they can pass the test and then shortly thereafter have high emissions again. What we want is those cars to be low emission all year long during the two-year registration cycle. So the idea is preventative, and the testing continues to be a value for that purpose. Another really important factor is that vehicles are under warranty. The emission control systems are under warranty for only a few years after the vehicle is new, and we want to make sure that if there's going to be a catastrophic failure, particularly, say, a bad catalytic converter or an expensive component, that that equipment is replaced while it's still under warranty. Otherwise, if we begin only testing vehicles when they're much older, we may catch a fairly expensive problem after the warranty period has expired. That said, we continue, as I mentioned in your office, we continue to look at that. What year should the testing begin? We used to test cars when they were 2 years old. Now we test cars when they're 4 years old, and we will keep looking at that to see whether at some point we should go to when cars are 6 years old or older. We need to, as I mentioned, stay in line with the warranty period. We don't want to catch expensive problems after the end of the warranty period. And we also want to keep this preventative aspect of the program. So we will continue to evaluate it and adjust it as we go on. Another factor just to be aware of is that EPA has recently proposed a revision to the ozone or the smog standard. They haven't finalized it yet. Their plan is to finalize it in June. But if they finalize the standard at the lower end of what they're considering, we could be looking at having a number of additional cities within our state that are violating the federal smog standard. In that case, we're going to have to go back and look again at what are all the emission sources that contribute to smog. It's not just cars. Cars are a big factor, and whether we need to do more with vehicle inspection or with fuels or with other measures. We may be looking at another round of planning to meet federal standards depending on what EPA does ultimately with the standard. So, again, just a commitment to continue looking at the vehicle inspection program and make sure it's as efficient as it can be.
Are there other questions? No other questions? Thank you very much.
If anybody else wants.
Yeah, if anyone else in the audience wants to testify or talk about the low carbon fuel standard, anybody that's on the task force or on the committee, the advisory committee, that would wish to opine on the progress of said committee?
For the record, John Rakowitz, and with Associated General Contractors, and I am a member of the Low Carbon Fuel Standard Committee and did not plan on speaking today, but I welcome the opportunity. I guess I would start with, just for the record, Phil, very similar, our industry does, as Senator Verger pointed out earlier. We don't have a problem with the concept. How this is done is extremely important to my industry and a lot of other industries and the general economic health of Oregon. So we're concerned about that. And I don't think there's any question. I think people are very vocal in that committee. It's a very large committee. So we were unable, despite every effort by a lot of folks, to support House Bill 2186, and it's since that time I've spent a fair amount of time in Southern Oregon, where a lot of this is migrating from, and that's probably what I would most point out to the committee members is I went to this fall to Southern Oregon. Everybody here knows, I believe, that in the last 20 months, our industry has a 34% decline in employment. That's pretty significant. We've got people laid off all over the state and companies closing and everything else in the world. So we're in an industry that is in a, well, you can only call it a more than a downturn. We'll just leave it at that. So what I've discovered in Southern Oregon, when you go to Klamath Falls, let's say, and you pull into a business there, a contracting business, every pickup in the parking lot will have two licenses. They'll have a license for California and they'll have a license for Oregon to conduct business. I can't tell you the number of stories of contractors in Southern Oregon who hold both licenses for both states to conduct business legitimately, who are down 50-60% in volume. If they had a $15 million volume business, now they have a $7 million. Or if they had a $3 million, they have a $1.5 million. Or less. They're refusing to go across the border because they do not know how to comply with the standards that the state of California has imposed. They will not, despite the fact that they are suffering those kinds of losses. So my warning here is not specific to low-carbon fuel standard. I think there are other industries that can speak more specifically to that. We are participating because we look at that. You look at the other issues that the DEQ representative just brought up, the other study called for in House Bill 2186. We're very concerned about that. We're, in fact, partnering with National AGC and many other states. We are challenging the retrofit in some of the standards that have been imposed on our industry in California, not on the law, but how they have counted what our industry is contributing. We believe it's inaccurate. So I guess the warning I would make is it's not one low-carbon fuel standard. It is all the things that were just referenced briefly. When you pile those on, I believe you could be looking at, and I don't believe I'm alone in this opinion, some real significant issues depending on how, when it's scheduled to meet those kind of standards, from retrofitting of equipment to low-carbon fuel standard to, I mean, we're talking broad impacts that I'll be really direct here. I question, and I believe others question as well, whether DEQ has the resources to do a thorough job of it. And that was an issue that we maintained when 2186 was before this committee and before both chambers. And I now believe that to be even more so true because I am in close contact with our national and California chapters. And there were tens of millions of hours that went into some of these regulations in California, and we don't believe they're accurate in their simple counting of what our one little industry actually contributes to the issue. So it's, again, we're not questioning the concept. Nobody wants bad air. Nobody wants to do damage to our environment. But how this is done, how long this takes, I suspect there 2011 will be a very interesting set of discussions. And I would strongly urge that everybody think about the pylon effect of all the different aspects and how they impact industry. So with that, I'd be happy to any questions. I didn't plan on speaking, but I sort of felt like, given some of those issues that were brought up, there's another perspective to represent.
So thank you for your comments. I'm reminded of the privilege that we had as a committee to sit in the Church of Chandler and hear a sermon in a previous committee. Yes. On a previous bill. Mm-hmm. I look at the cumulative effect of the regulatory approach that this legislature, previous legislatures, have had as it relates to hamstringing business in the state. And at some point in time, you turn around and look, well, what have we accomplished? And as it relates to the previous bill, what it accomplishes is we send a lot of jobs overseas because industry can't do business in the United States. We have significantly high unemployment, and Oregon has has over the last several years been in the number 1, 2, 3, 4 top 10 of the highest unemployment states in any state in the union. And I look at this as just another way to regulate business, private sector, make it more difficult for us to do business. I agree. I mean, nobody's interested
you know, having dirty air or, you know, not having an environment that's unhealthy. And the chair made an absolutely appropriate statement that the vehicles, particularly that are on the road today, are, for the most part, unbelievably clean compared to where they were, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s. Part of that has been because of federal regulations, but a lot of it has just been because of the pressure on industry to improve the product, and the public has demanded a certain amount of that. So I'm just, as I look at this, you know, I didn't support 2186 for a variety of reasons, particularly the Section 10 that ties land use and transportation together. And I represent a part of the state that would like to attract lots more industrial investment and, you know, have suitors come knocking on our doors and you don't have land available for them to occupy. We don't, you know, because of other regulations, you can't expand the urban growth boundary to allow it. You know, this is a slippery slope when we turn around and look, well, what have we created? And I think it leaves us scratching our head at times.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, the one thing I'll say, I'll give a real concrete example. Off-road equipment, construction industry. If you're a construction contractor today, the number one thing you have on your balance sheet, the only real asset you can have is the equipment. This is mostly diesel equipment, a lot of it off-road, and it lives for a long time. It operates for a long time. If regulations come requiring the retrofit of that equipment, and you're either the equipment doesn't exist, it's too expensive, you don't have the capital to invest in it within the time frame, your one capital asset just disappeared. In fact, it's a loss because it no longer is valuable because nobody else will buy it because it's had no value on the market. So I guess my point is the practicality of this, and this is just one tiny industry. I'm not trying to speak for all, but there are these kinds of questions across a bunch of industries. It can have an overall impact on our overall employment and our overall future economics. And what's scary is when a bill passes that presumes you're going to have a new policy by July 2011, but we don't know what that schedule looks like. We don't know how fast somebody or how available equipment will be. That's just one little tiny example. So I think the cumulative effect is really important to consider when individual bills or individual reports are coming forward to you so that you can see the full effect. I think that's what I think I'm just reiterating kind of from our perspective what you said, Senator Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was recently told that there is a move in the state of California to gather signatures to create a ballot measure that would basically set aside all of their emission standards, all of these carbon footprint things, until their budget's balanced and their economy comes back. Have you heard any about this?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, I have not. I'm caught up in just trying to keep up with what's going on in our industry, frankly. There's so many of these things coming at a federal and or being established in the state of California. I felt strongly enough that we do, that we're engaged now in California simply because we think to a large extent, and I think the representative from DEQ was pretty clear about that, a lot of what's coming Oregon's way is being imported from California, which, so we figure whatever's going on in California, we need to understand how accurate it is, what it really does, and there are daily press releases coming out of AGC America about the direct closing of doors of multiple contractors because of some of the standards, not the low carbon fuel standard necessarily, but the other standards associated with some of the other studies in House Bill 2186. So I don't know about that. I am so caught up just trying to figure out what we can do for our industry before it hits Oregon's construction industry that I'm just not able to answer your question. Sorry.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to comment on the processes? Again, we're not re-debating the issue because it is very interesting, but we're updating on how the process is going from your standpoint.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Tom O'Connor, representing Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. Where angels fear to tread, I guess. I just want a couple quick comments. I think the legislature did absolutely the right thing in making sure that this work that's being done in the interim comes back before any of this triggers. I think that's critical. We are involved with the task force. I don't know whether, you know, the timeline is really tight. There's a lot of unanswered questions. I'm not sure where we're going to end up. But I guess I do want to put in a plug for the fact that, at least in our experience so far, this has been an opportunity to get at some of the issues that are connected and important to us as electric utilities. And that is, as electric utilities, we're under a great deal of pressure right now to reduce our emissions, even if they're very low, and somehow be able to deal with load growth and at the same time keep our emissions low. If at the same time the policy is to move people to electric vehicles, that in some ways is almost directly counter to that approach, because it's going to mean for us increased growth in load, and at the same time when we're being asked to put to lower emissions. The one good thing that I will say about this task force, and we've been pleased about, is there has been an opportunity to look at that interrelationship and how we're going to deal with it and how the transportation sector and the electric utility sector are related and how we have to deal with that dichotomy. So I'm glad that at least there's an opportunity to get that on the table, have some discussion. I don't know where we're going to end up. I don't know how the timing's going to be, but I think that, I guess I just put that plug in for the process.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just a comment following up what he said and what the chair said a few minutes ago. There's actually an article that was in Economist a few weeks back about that certain neighborhoods are at night experiencing brownouts who have high income areas that have electrical vehicles, that the load was never meant to take on that many electrical vehicles. And so they're being forced to go into these neighborhoods and retrofit their entire electrical grid to match the draw from electrical vehicles, and how much that's actually going to impact. You know, you got to redo everything all the way through. And so there are these unintended consequences that we get into. We're trying to do good things, but there's these unintended consequences. And I just thought it was interesting that both you and last witness brought that up, and that was in The Economist just about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, it usually happens with my hairdryer and my old fuse box, but yeah, the cars would especially do that. Anybody else wish to comment on how the process is going at this time? One thing, what we're going to do, and this is why this is part of this, and I know it's still early in the process, is there'll be a lot of these reports during the interim, and what at least I see a great value is you really start getting into the nitty-gritty, and if you are identifying issues that you feel are not being properly addressed, that's what we kind of want to hear at that point and why it isn't. So I realize it's early now, but your information is going to be very, very important to us, because we want to be able to have some kind of weighing in on the work of this process before it maybe is too far down the road in some area that we think needs some oversight. So I appreciate everybody's hard work. I know it's very, very difficult, but we'll be having many conversations about it. So we'll close that informational hearing, and I'm going to return now to our final work process of today and open a work session on House Bill 3676A. We have a dash A6 amendment. I'll get to that in a second. We adopted an A4. Is that what we did?
We have adopted the A4 on House Bill 3676, correct.
Okay. So let me explain just briefly what we have here. Senator Starr has made a modification on what we've already adopted, which is the work zone, in which we had changed the definition of the work zone. And correct me if I'm right, Ms. Senator Starr, but we've essentially just returned the original definition of the work zone as one of the primary changes to what we had had, because there was some concern that by changing the definition of the work zone created some angst.
Yeah, so the amendment that we've already adopted changes the definition of work zones across the board.
Okay.
whether they're workers present or not, it just makes it a change across the board. That wasn't really my intention. My intention really was to have it so that the doubling of the fines would only apply if workers were present, and not that work zones only were applied, or the definition of work zones only applied if workers were present. I mean, work zones are there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as long as the work is going on. My intention is that we only have the double fines when the workers are working. And so that's the change in this dash A6 amendment. So, Mr. Chair, I believe we need to
extend
the A4s and adopt the A6s.
We will. Before we go ahead with that, Mr. Donnelly, you want to comment on the revision at all? Does the department want to comment on it at all? So does everyone understand that Senator Starr had an unintentional change in the work zone definition? We're not changing that. It's only the applicability of the double fine is when the and does the same thing. So what we would need, Senator, is a motion to reconsider the vote by which we adopted the A4 amendment. We'll bring it back in front of us, and then we'll do the A6.
So moved.
Senator Starr has moved that we reconsider the vote by which we adopted the A4 amendment in our previous hearing on House Bill 3676A. Is there any objection? So ordered. Do we need to have we withdrawn it, or we have to make
that
motion?
Make a motion
to withdraw it.
Yes. As long as it's clear to everyone, I think it would be proper to make.
Let's go ahead and do it. Be clear.
Mr. Chair, I move that we rescind the amendment of House Bill 3676 with the A4 amendments to bring the bill back before us as it came over from the House.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved that we withdraw the A4 amendment that was previously adopted to House Bill 3676A. Any discussion? Is there any objection? So now we have the original bill as unamended before us.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd move that we adopt the A6 amendment to House Bill 3676.
Right. Senator Starr has moved the dash A6 amendment to House Bill 3676A, which is the same amendment we did, except for the change that Senator Starr has articulated. Any discussion on that? Any objection? So ordered. We need one more motion now to send the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move that we I move the bill to the Senate for as amended with the A6 amendments with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3676 as amended by the A6 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I'm
Mr. Stemblish.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm the committee staff.
You sometimes make me wonder, but we do appreciate it.
I'm getting to be entirely
too assertive,
I know. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to mention the fiscal impact statement. Every fiscal impact statement we've gotten on this bill, all the different provisions have been minimal, although it does come in a officially written statement. Mm-hmm. The reason they write the statement is, if you've seen any of the statements, it says that there would be a large fiscal impact of not moving the main portion of the bill.
Okay. Reverse impact. Okay. Any objection to the motion? All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Where is the section about the work area?
It's on page...
Section what?
Section 18.
18? Okay.
Yeah. That had changed, but now the original language is restored. So that's how it always was.
We had changed it, but now it's unchanged.
Okay. The definition of the work.
All right.
So it's just the fine.
All right. Late in the day.
It's okay. It is.
All right.
Any objection? So, Senator Starr, I'll ask you to carry. Now, one thing, members, I have been informed by the President's office that we may be receiving a bill this afternoon for tomorrow.
Okay.
It shouldn't take us long. I don't know exactly what time, but we will be here. It's not going to be a time that we're not here, whether it's in the morning or 1 o'clock or whatever. So we are likely to have one more bill to process.
Alrighty.
So Mr. Stembridge will be informed by the President's office if we receive the bill. It'll have to be posted before we leave today. So we'll know what time. But it would, if that happens, I would anticipate it would only take a few minutes, but just kind of be alert for one more meeting to get together.
So that's tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Okay.
And your staffs know what your schedule is so that we can try to arrange a time.
Can you tell us
that's a Thursday schedule?
Mm-hmm.
Do we know what it is?
We're here.
He knows, but he can't tell.
Oh, shit.